From health and wellness to education,
we need to be thinking about what it takes for students to succeed.
From art and politics to social issues of the day,
we have young Black males who are thriving in their communities and who are being shown as leaders.
The journey is what matters.
I would say to all of us, we can be better than we are.
Let's join Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, president of Howard University, and his guests as they take steps on the journey.
When it comes to speaking on behalf of children and families, no one does it better than my guest today. She has dedicated her life to advocating for disadvantaged Americans and has made waves on behalf of the vulnerable. Hello, I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick, and my guest is the founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund, Mrs. Marion Wright Edelman. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell me about growing up in Bennettsville, South Carolina.
Oh, it was awful and wonderful. It was awful because it was segregated, and I had a Jim Crow childhood with hand-me-down books from the white schools, hand-me-down football uniforms, everything from the white schools. All the public facilities were closed. We had white and black drinking water, and it was. And I cannot stand to this day seeing any child excluded from anything. But the good side of my childhood is I had great parents and great community co-parents, because nobody raises a child alone, who made it very clear that the problems of the external world were not things that God created and we could change them, and that when you see a problem, you try to change it. And we had great role models, and people ask me why I do what I do. I do exactly what my parents did. And my daddy was a Baptist minister, my mother the church organizer, and church organist as well. And yeah, when they saw that we couldn't have a playground uptown or have a drugstore, lunch counter, Coca-Cola, they built a playground and a skating rink behind our church. There were no homes for the aged for blacks, so they started one across the street, and all of us children had to cook and clean, and I sure didn't like it at the time, but that's how we learned that everybody was our neighbor. And I would wake up, and there would be another child in my bedroom. And my mother, after we left home, her children, natural children, but she adopted 12 foster sisters and brothers. So it never occurred to me. Daddy said that God runs a full employment economy, and if you just follow the need, you'll never lack for something meaningful to do in life. And so they didn't tell us what to do. They showed us what to do, and so I'm very grateful for that great legacy of service.
Now, growing up, you met some of Americans' icons and listened to them preach, etc. Tell me about some of those experiences.
Well, they always tried to be clear that the world was bigger than our segregated small town. If there was a great speaker coming within 100 miles, Daddy would drag us off in the car. I went to hear Marian Anderson, my namesake, and Dartha Mena, and Roland Hayes, and I saw Mrs. Bethune at Benedict College when I was, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old, but I'd never seen a black woman command a room of men, and she regaled them with stories. And that's the first time I ever heard the black of the berry, the sweet of the juice. Now, one of the things I got to admit that I didn't like, every year or so, Dr. Mordecai Johnson would come and speak at the Columbia Auditorium. That was our capital. It was 100 miles away. And Daddy would put us all in the car to go hear Dr. Johnson. They had the hardest chairs you ever did see. And he would always speak for about 4 hours with an intermission. And we used to moan. But, you know, I think I'm so grateful because I believe in osmosis with children. You expose children, and while you may not like it at the time, they kind of get it. And Dr. Mays had to stay at our house because we had no places for people to live, but he came to speak at our church. And so that was one of the good sides of segregation. So we were always told that the world is bigger than what the segregated world said, and we always had books in our house. We didn't have a second pair of shoes, but we always had books. And
talk about this, your dad's instructions to you when he passed at the age of 14, and what was that like?
Well, don't let anything get between you and your education. And he was very clear as I went with him in the ambulance to the hospital that, you know, gender and race are not important, that it's about character and perseverance. But that was the way he lived. And the other thing my daddy said that night is that don't be afraid, God is here with us. And he believed in the 139th Psalm that there's nowhere you can go that God is not.
Why Spelman College, where you got your bachelor's
degree? Well, I didn't want to go to Spelman. I wanted to go to Fisk. My sister went to Fisk, but I had gotten into early admission at Fisk, but then my daddy died, and my mother didn't want me going that far away, and I was the last child. And we had a great family debate about whether in 1954, Daddy died the week before Brown came down. We used to wait for the Supreme Court decision every Monday morning, and he died the week before. But whether one should be going to an integrated college or trying to desegregate colleges or whether you should go somewhere else. I am so glad about that decision. I believe in Providence. I rebelled against Spelman Strick. We had to be in by 5 o'clock. We had to go out in groups of threes. We had to have, you know, hats on and gloves on, and we were proper tea pouring ladies, and it was the perfect context for rebellion. And we had compulsory chapel every morning and on Wednesday prayer meetings and Sunday vespers, but you know, and I rebelled against compulsory chapel, but first thing I did when I got to chair Spelman's board was to reinstitute compulsory chapel, because I remember more about that than anything. It's where we heard the Dr. Howard Thurmans and all the great preachers and Dr. Mays and all who came through, and I think it's so important that adults say what is important and what we value, and so all the great speakers, including Dr. King, that's the first place I heard Dr. King, came through Spelman College's chapel.
You're listening to The Journey. My guest today is Marion Wright Edelman. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Now, to change gears a little bit, you had a Spelman experience, which then spurred you on to Yale Law School and subsequently becoming the first black woman admitted to the Mississippi Bar. What was that experience like, making the transition from Spelman to Yale back to Mississippi?
Well, Spelman had sent me away for 15 months as a Merrill Scholar in foreign scholarship, and I thought I wanted to become a foreign service person, and I did. But at any rate, I ended up with the sit-in movement, and again, following Daddy's, following the need, I went down and volunteered between the sit-ins and the next thing we were planning to do as students at the local NAACP. And there were all these complaints from poor people who couldn't get lawyers. White lawyers didn't take civil rights cases, and people didn't have money. And I had to ask myself, what am I thinking about doing, going to a foreign service institute, and the big battle is right here at home. Mm-hmm. And I went down to Mississippi in 1961, in the spring of, in April 1961, and Medgar Evers picked me up at the airport. Drove me home to meet Merle and his three children, and then he drove me up to Greenwood, Mississippi, where the SNCC headquarters were, 90-plus miles away. And at that time, we had three black lawyers in the state who hadn't gone to law school but who were very brave, and they kept me alive. And I think if I'd been a black male, I probably wouldn't be here today, because I could get away with stuff as a woman. But he drove me up, and there was a shooting that night, and he got briefed on that, and then he drove himself back 90-plus miles back to Jackson, Mississippi, and I just say, how many of us would take the time to do that first? I mean, I'd been in law school 3 months, okay? Yeah. And next morning, I went to the SNCC office where Bob Moses and all of my SNCC friends, Jim Foreman, all were there trying to register people to vote, and they were terrified by the shooting. And they decided to do a march downtown to let people know that violence was not going to deter them from trying to seek their right to vote. And I promised my mama that I wouldn't get arrested, and I promised, we had a white professor from Mississippi at Yale Law School, so they're not going to ever let you in anyway, but if you get yourself into trouble, you're never going to get in the bar. But at any rate, I hung on to the end of the line with these people, and I will never forget what a ragged line that was. And SNCC people had enticed them across the road with breakfast, and hunger was always a problem in the Mississippi Delta. And I went toward the end of the line, and that was the first time it turned out that they brought out police dogs in the South. And Bob Moses and Jim Foreman and others were leading the line, and there was this huge white mob that was surrounding the Trailway bus station as we were getting close to the courthouse. And when people saw those police dogs, they obviously were determined to. They were scared. I was scared. But Bob did not stop. He's one of the bravest men I have ever seen, and he kept marching forward. And the first dog lunged and ripped his pants, and he did not move. And all the SNCC leaders at the beginning began to throw their car keys to me, which I caught. And the people, those people, they were on crutches. They were just, I mean, it was a scraggly bunch of poor people trying to be free you ever did see. Mm-hmm. And I got all these car keys, and the people scattered, and the dogs, you know, I will never forget. And they immediately arrested all the SNCC kids, and they rushed them off to the courthouse, which was about a block off. I remember I had one telephone number in my pocket, and that was John Doors in the Civil Rights Division. And I called him, And I was trying to describe this scene of all the arrest and all this lawlessness is going on. In his steely voice, he said, just stop the emotion and give me the facts. But then I at that moment, with a telephone booth and this man way away in Washington, D.C., I began to understand what it felt like to be a helpless, hopeless, lawyerless black citizen in Mississippi. So I ran out of that telephone booth. I went to the courthouse in Greenwood, LaFleur County, and tried to get up the front step. The mobs had moved to the courthouse. And the three black lawyers were all in Jackson, 90 miles away, and they were going to try them immediately. And I tried to go up to the front door steps. They wouldn't let me in. And I got so mad that it got me through law school. I knew that I could get through law school, and I knew that I could practice law. And I've never, it was a wonderful 4 years.
Absolutely. Now, the Children's Defense Fund is certainly one of the things that you have done in your life's work when you talk about service that has really impacted the nation as a whole. Tell me why it's, or how it started, and why today it still continues to thrive and be so important.
Well, I now know it started in my childhood because I followed the need. And Mississippi, the 4 years in Mississippi were, and I still keep a Mississippi office, and I get my reports on Monday morning, and I know what has changed and not changed. But I was exposed to the most courageous people. I mean, Mrs. Hamer, Miss May Bertha Carter. I mean, these were Mr. Turnbull. I mean, I look back, and extraordinary courage. And they all wanted a better life for their children. And that 4 years, beginning with the Mississippi, I went down in 1963 after getting out of law school. I went to the Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP, and the Lord will open up a way. I had no idea how I was going to eat. I had student loans. But, you know, there was a new fellowship program that opened up that first year right in time for giving me a year of the best training I ever had. I could have substituted my 3 years of law school for the year I had with Connie Motley and Derek Bell and Jack Greenberg. I mean, we couldn't. And it was to help two lawyers, young lawyers, go back south. And Julius Chambers was the other intern, and he went to Charlotte. And he became later the head of the Legal Defense Fund. And I went to Mississippi. But I went in time to set up legal factories, I call them, in anticipation of the 1964 summer project where all the white kids came in and to register people to vote. And we ran legal factories, and it was a heck of a summer. And the first thing that happened, as you all know, was the killing of those three young men in Philadelphia, Mississippi. It was Andrew Goodman's first day down in Mississippi, and it was deeply moving. So it was an extraordinary summer. We had volunteer lawyers, but then everybody left. All the lawyers left after the summer, and I was left with hundreds of cases to solve. But with unbelievable courageous people who were left alone and retaliated against. But let me just, I wouldn't give anything in the world for it. And everything I do with the Children's Defense Fund comes out of Bennisville, South Carolina, out of Mississippi. And hunger, they wanted to push everybody out of the state, poor sharecroppers, and they began to take away food stamps instead of public commodities, food commodities, and hunger was rampant. The thing that saved us the second year was that Head Start came about. And the state turned it down like they've turned down Medicaid. I never will understand how anybody would take away billions of dollars from poor people. But they wanted to starve them out. They wanted them to leave. They didn't want them to vote. And so community groups were able to get the Head Start program, and they immediately began to attack it and say we were communists and wasting money, all the other stuff. Run your program well, because they always go after the jugular of are you misspending money. But the bottom line, it set up 3,000 new jobs for poor black people out of the plantation structure, and it was a revolution. During that first summer as well, there was the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Challenge in New Jersey. The bottom line was that the next 3 years turned out to be extraordinary. But why we're here in many ways is the massive hunger that came. I was running up and back to Washington trying to say feed people. And out of the attacks on Head Start, we had hearings. And I one day out of my mouth came, even though I was up to talk about Head Start, people were starving. Children were starving. And Bobby Kennedy was there, and he agreed to come down. And the senators came down. And we, and again, it was about Head Start. But eventually I sort of said, I hope you'll come up to the Delta. I don't know where that came from either. But they all agreed. They agreed. And we got in the car the next day, and they went up there, and they saw babies with bloated bellies, and they saw the, and so Kennedy was able to bring the press in, which earlier people people that we'd taken up there to see it couldn't. But child hunger and child poverty, my passion about it came out of that period, and I'm grateful.
Excellent. Thanks for being here. My guest today has been Marion Wright Edelman. I'm Dr. Wayne Frederick. Please join me next time on The Journey.
You've been listening to The Journey with Dr. Wayne A.I. Frederick, right here on the Howard University Radio Network.